This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the past few days, we've learned that the white South African government funded rallies by the Inkatha movement, rallies that opposed international sanctions against apartheid. Inkatha is a Zulu group that is the rival of the African National Congress. The ANC had previously accused Inkatha of being a puppet of the government. My guest, Emma Mashinini, is a longtime opponent of apartheid and was for years a leader in the black trade union movement. She was the first general secretary of the Commercial Catering and Allied Workers Union of South Africa. In 1981, she was arrested and held without trial for 6 months. The only time she was allowed out of the cell was to be interrogated. For the past 5 years, Mashinini has worked with the families of detainees and political prisoners in her role as the director of the Anglican Church's Department of Justice and Reconciliation. She works with Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Mashinini is visiting the States because her autobiography has just been published here. It's called Strikes Have Followed Me All My Life. I asked her reaction to the news that the South African government had secretly funded Inkatha.
The first thing that came to me was, thank God that this has happened, because it did not come as a big surprise. We knew that there was something happening somewhere. And why it really came as a joy, it is a joy that perhaps all the violence that has been taking place in the country will now stop.
Are you hoping that there will be evidence that a lot of the black against black fighting in South Africa will have actually been organized and funded by whites?
Yes, we did think that the intervention from the white South African regime has not been valid. They have not intervened in a way to bring this violence to an end. I hope that even the Western world must begin to question itself. If the government can stop so many things, why could the South African regime not be able to stop the violence between the black on black, as it was termed? Black life has become so cheap. People have died in great numbers. So we were now concerned about, and the two parties were talking to each other, which thing did not happen in the past. People have been working around the clock to bring this violence to an end, yet someone is busy orchestrating it from behind. It does not matter which side the people are dying, it is black people who are dying, be they Inkatha or ANC.
Now that it's been revealed that the white government was funding Inkatha, what effect do you think that will have on negotiations on the end of white minority rule?
In fact, now, I really think that I wonder what is going on back at home. This comes immediately after your President Bush has announced the lifting of the sanctions. He is lifting the sanctions because they are so impressed about F.W. de Klerk and his group, and they are wonderful people. They have done so much in South Africa. I wonder what comes to the mind of President Bush himself with this revelation of what is happening in South Africa, because it is the same man, and it is going to stall. I can foresee that it is going to stall the negotiations.
Do you think that the United States prematurely lifted the sanctions against South Africa?
Oh, yes. The timing was very bad. It was really premature, because we needed the sanctions now more than ever before. The reason why we needed them more than ever before is because the process of change had begun, as it has been announced in the papers. That process of change needed to be monitored and to be pressurized to be taken a little further. And the only thing which had to monitor that, it is the sanctions. Now, with the lifting of the sanctions, what other weapon do we have to monitor that the implementation of what has begun should really take place? Because we've had enough of violence. We don't want violence. We want anything that is going to take us out of this suffering with peace.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Emma Mashinini, and she's a former union activist in South Africa and now works with Desmond Tutu in the Anglican Church as the church's director of the Department of Justice and Reconciliation. And she's written a new autobiography called Strikes Have Followed Me All My Life. What were the direct ways in which the sanctions affected you in day-to-day life? Were there things that you were willing to sacrifice, but that you had to sacrifice with the sanctions in effect?
I cannot point out to say these are the things that I had to sacrifice, because there isn't much which one has had long before the sanctions. Yes, there's unemployment, but I've grown up. I'm not a young person. I am 62. I've grown up to know, to find that there are people unemployed. And even during, long before the sanctions, there was job reservation. Jobs were reserved for whites, which was better jobs. Only menial jobs were there open for black people when there was no white who can do that particular menial job. Job reservation meant that they can actually even go for the retired white person to come and fill in a job. If they cannot find a retired person, they would go for retarded white people to come and do the job. Only when they do not have those people, then you had the opportunity as a black person. So that was not because of sanctions. It was partly because of apartheid itself, that we did not have the job opportunities in the country, and we did not have the necessary training and qualifications because of the poor, very inferior education which exists in our country.
What were some of the most important things that you fought for in the unions that you represented?
The first thing, we were fighting for the recognition of the trade unions itself. And after that, we were very concerned, the workers were very concerned about the working conditions, the improvement on wages. And for the women, we had really achieved a great thing in 1983, that we managed to achieve the maternity right benefits for women in South Africa. Our union was a black-only union at that time, because there was a white union operating. Everything in South Africa is done according to compartments. But when we achieved these rights for women, for maternity benefits, it's not just the black woman who benefited from it. Even the white woman benefited from it.
Emma Mashinini is my guest. We'll talk about her imprisonment in South Africa after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Emma Mashinini is my guest, and she's written a new autobiography about her life as a union activist in South Africa. Now, you were arrested and held for 6 months without trial. Mm. Can you describe what happened the day they came for you?
Oh, on the morning when they came for me, which was very early in the morning, and they came in several cars, and they were quite a number, more than 10 or so. And when they came, you know, as they would knock at the door, they knock at every window. They kick, they bang, they do everything. You open this door, they are all over. And when they got in, they just said to my family they should get out of the house. And my husband wanted to know why. And they said, you get out, I'm being detained. And they said they were detaining me under Section 22. And they started searching and ransacking the house with everybody out of the house. I state in the book that after searching, after having done everything, when they were about to take me away, and then they called my family in. Well, there was a pile of books. I do have a lot of books. And then they wanted my husband to sign for those books as things which they were taking away. And he refused and said, how can I sign for them? What if you brought them here to incriminate Emma? And it was a big issue in itself. And then they took me away to my office, to my workplace, to go and search, which was where the Council of Churches was. And many people came to give me moral support. And they took me to prison. And the first time I was imprisoned in Pretoria Central Prison, and locked up with people who are on the death row.
Yeah, so you thought you would be sentenced to death?
Oh, yes. I don't know what for. Because you were just waiting. You see, they're waiting and expecting to hear from them that you will be going to court or doing anything to know why you are there. And nothing happens. And then the next thing, you are just told, pack your bags, come. And then when you go, you think you are being released, yet you are being moved from one prison to another.
When you were arrested, you were the general secretary of a trade union, the Commercial Catering and Allied Workers Union of South Africa. Did they give you any reasons for arresting you? Did you know why they had singled you out?
Never. I did not know up until the day when they left me to go home. The same way they arrested me, the same way they left me, I did not know why they arrested me and why did they release me at the same time. But it was a very horrible time just to be left alone for 6 months in solitary confinement. It was one of the horrible tortures that could happen to one.
Would you describe the cell that you were held in solitary confinement?
The first cell I was held in solitary confinement in Pretoria. I state in the book that it was so clean, small and neat because I reckon I was locked up in a section which I think was must have been reserved for whites or whatever. And the reason for that is they hide you away from even the prison warders or anybody who is working in the prison or any other person that they must never see you or see your face. I was locked up and never was to go out because the toilet and everything is there. They sealed the window and just left a very little strip for them to peep and see me from outside, and I could not see from inside, outside. I could just see the two eyes peeping at me, which was very scary. And even if they brought food, someone had to lock that. The doors were locked until someone would come and just open the door and push the food. I was moved to yet another cell, which was now very huge, big, and very dirty, with no window, windows right up there. You don't see the sun. You don't know what is happening. And it was like it was under the rail because I could hear the trains, you know, the noise of like the trains where I was.
Did you completely lose track of what was day and what was night and how many days had elapsed?
Well, I had, towards the end, I definitely did lose track of that. But more than losing track of the days and so forth, the most important thing that happened to me is that because you sit there, we had no books, we had nothing at the very beginning except towards the end. It was one day I sat there thinking about my family and, you know, talking to them, you know, just in my imaginations. And I saw my baby and I wanted to talk to her and call her by name. And I discovered that I could not remember my baby's name. I had forgotten my own baby's name. And this took me days to remember who her name was. This was one of the worst tortures which happened to me by me and I torturing myself to remember my own child's name.
How did it come back to you?
I think after many days of thinking of nothing and recollecting and when the day, when it did come, I fell asleep. I slept for the day.
Oh, out of relief?
Out of relief. Out of relief of remembering my child's name.
The only time you really left your cell was to be interrogated and tortured. What kind of information did you feel they wanted from you? What kinds of questions were they asking you?
Oh, they ask you questions about my own work, about my work in the trade unions. They ask me questions about the numerous strikes which had taken place and just my operational, my day-to-day work, and ask me questions about some of the co-trade unions who I worked with. Worst of all, on the day of my being detained, I was detained with Dr. Neil Agat, who was a trade unionist himself, and he was a white medical doctor. And they kept asking me questions about him. And what angers me even today is that Neil Agat died in prison. And when I got to know, because I did not know about this, when I got to know when Neil had died and just thought about it, that I was being tortured about Neil when They actually knew that he was already dead, but they still tortured me, asking me questions about Neil.
How were you able to not give them the information? What did you do to resist?
I had no information which I had to give. I had nothing to hide. So there was no resistance because I had nothing to tell them and I had nothing to hide. Whatever I was doing, I told them the truth. And they just thought, it is not enough. There's something more than that.
What did they do when they tortured you?
Oh, well, they would make you sit for hours or question you for almost the whole day. I never had any physical attacks or whatever, except being sworn at, being pushed around and so forth. But I was never punched or anything. But I think that psychological torture is even worse than the physical torture. That's why when I left prison, I was whisked away and had to go to Denmark to a center for tortured people just to get my health and my normality back. And I have had to be exposed to get psychotherapy for a long time to get myself back to normal health.
When you were released, before you went to Denmark, to the center for torture victims, what was it like for you at home? What were some of the fears that were uncontrollable?
Oh, yes, the fears were very uncontrollable. When you had cars coming, you'd think that here they are coming back for me again. And I've had some relapses, especially when it comes to the month of November. You know, I've had memory losses. I have been seen walking in the streets, partly naked, not properly dressed, not knowing where I am going to. I've been admitted into mental hospitals, and this came about all because of the imprisonment, unnecessary, uncalled for imprisonment by the South African regime.
Now, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong here, but I have a feeling that a lot of people, when they leave the Denmark Center for torture victims, that they go back to a safer country, not to the country that they were tortured in. Whereas you went back home.
Yeah, I had to go back home. I have no other place to go back to. And besides, the struggle that one has been fighting for is the struggle for the freedom of South Africa. I am one of the lucky people to have gone to Denmark. And at the same time, if it meant me having to live outside South Africa, I had a daughter who was studying in Germany and another one over here. But this is not home for me or neither for them. And even my children, they insisted, Ma, we'd like to see you back home. To continue with the struggle, which we had begun, that we want to have our freedom. So I had to go back home. Home is home.
What was some of the most effective therapy that you had in Denmark?
Well, I had a very good woman doctor in Denmark who was... I didn't even know what it is to have psychotherapy. And we know little about it. Even many people at home don't know anything about it. That's why I repeat it in the book so many times, that there is a thing called psychotherapy, which we have never been exposed to. She used to talk to me. She used to give me the necessary treatment. But it was not, I can say regrettably, it did not help me very much because it was almost like another isolation. I was in Denmark with a lot of people who came from Chile, from Guatemala, from so forth, those people who we could not communicate with. And I still wanted to be home because I've come out of prison. When I was in prison, I wanted to be my family. So I still really wanted to be home and to be with my family.
So you left early. You left before the treatment was officially over.
Yeah, I left before the treatment was officially over. When I left, I went and stayed for almost a month with my daughter in Germany. And we've always been in touch with my doctor, with all my doctors in Denmark. We have always been in touch, even when I'm back in South Africa. Up until now, we still are very much in touch with them.
You've never been arrested again, have you?
Oh, but I've been called in and interrogated.
Oh,
and
really?
At home, they come to my home or want me to come to the police station. If you read the book a little further, you will get to a part where you find that security say that you are a globetrotter, you've been all over the world, and you have not had a good word for South Africa, but you keep coming back to South Africa. Those are one of the interrogations which have been going on even after I've been released.
How do you deal with the interrogations now?
Oh, I think I'm much stronger now. I'm much stronger to face up with the interrogations.
How so? What do you do that's different?
You are able to react strongly, and you just don't give in easily to people pushing you around. And too many people have been detained. People have suffered much more than myself. And we just thought that we cannot give in so easily to these people who are oppressing us.
You're working with families of people who are imprisoned and detained. How now is the kind of people being imprisoned changing, or the things that they're being imprisoned for, now that the emergency laws aren't in effect?
Well, I think that the numbers are really coming down. The numbers of detainees have dwindled, but not all political people, prisoners, are out of prison. But most of the people who are being detained have been released. We still have some who the human rights lawyers are still talking about, and even those people who are on the death row for political reasons who have not as yet been released, we are concerned about them, and we are still working around that issue of capital punishment.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Terry. It was good talking to you.
And my guest has been Emma Mashanini, and she's written an autobiography called Strikes Have Followed Me All My Life. She's a union activist and human rights activist in South Africa. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.